The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
What we're going to do now is leave it all behind and talk about something else completely. So let's escape back 50 years ago. I suppose we can all pick a sort of high watermark in popular culture, whether you think it's 1955, 1967, 1976. I think it can depend on your age, in fairness. But author and broadcaster David Hepworth, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And you reckon that 50 years ago, 1971, was rock's golden year?
Well, it was certainly the golden year of the rock album, which is what I wrote my book, 1971, Never a Dull Moment, all about. It was the years that left us with most records that we still play. I'm talking about the likes of Carole King's Tapestry and Marvin Gaye's What's Going On and the Who's Next and Led Zeppelin 4 and Hunky Dory by David Bowie and so forth. So I think there was a particular zenith there for the LP record, which had pretty much only recently been invented as a big major popular format. So it was the prime form of home entertainment at that point, because it's before the VHS, it's before multi-channel TV, obviously, and so forth. And so there was a huge focus on the LP record, which there never really was again, not quite to the same extent.
And what do you think, why was it 1971, do you think? So the 60s was kind of over, but I guess the 70s, as we would come to know them, hadn't quite started, maybe. So is it positioned there between the 60s and 70s almost?
I suppose it is. And it's also, you had a huge kind of flowering of talent that had come up through the 60s and had been, you know, kind of on the road in the 60s and doing television in the 60s and so forth, suddenly making long playing records where they could kind of pretty much do what they wanted. And the beauty of the way they made records in those days is they didn't take all that long about them, because we like to say that pop music nowadays moves far more quickly than it used to move in the past. Well, that's not the case. It's absolutely the other way around. Back in 1971, they moved very quickly. And so, you know, David Bowie and loads of other people would make two albums in 1971. So they didn't have the time to linger over records to the extent that it takes to spoil them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They did things quite quickly. And they were also, let's not forget, they were quite young. You know, they were 25, 26 years old. So they weren't trying to recall past glories. They were just, they felt whatever they were doing, they were kind of doing it for the first time. They were, you know, enjoying a kind of new freedom to do things. Later on in the 70s, you start to get people looking back, trying to do again, self-consciously, what they once did naturally.
Yes.
So, you know, my
theory on it, David, is that people have, a lot of musicians have a 10-year period that often coincides with their 20s, maybe, where they're just pouring out work effortlessly almost. And then really after that, they're just kind of chasing that, aren't they, for the rest
they're
of their
trying
careers.
To get it back. And of course, we, the audience, who they've gained in the 10 years, although I would even say it's 3 years, actually.
Okay.
They gain that audience, and that audience doesn't go away. And so that audience wishes to be reminded of the past. And so there's a great, you know, there's great pressure on them to recapture something that they once did for the first time, you know. And it's slightly tragic, actually. But we do
tend to stick with them and kind of come halfway to meet them for the rest of their careers, don't we, out
absolutely.
Of a kind of a loyalty,
and that's,
yeah.
That's the thing that nobody predicted, you know, that pop star was supposed to be the job that had the career expectancy of a mayfly.
Yeah.
Has ended up, ironically, being the longest lasting career of all. You can't play top level sports past the age of 35, but you can be a member of the Rolling Stones when you're nearly 80. You can't even be a high court judge at that kind of age, you know, but you can still do that. Nobody predicted that at all. So lots of the people who kind of, you know, made their reputation in 1971 are still famous now. You know, and these records, and John Lennon's Imagine, Paul McCartney's Ram, Rod Stewart's Every Picture Tells a Story, all these records are still played nowadays. And if these people got onto a stage now, that's still the material that people want to hear them play.
And in a funny way, the I suppose the music business kind of suits that now. It suits people with that back catalogue because the money isn't in releasing new music anymore, is it?
Well, it can be if you're at the very top of your game. I think I'm sure if you're Taylor Swift or Drake or whatever, I think they're probably doing every bit as well as anybody ever did in the past. But yes, it's certainly, you know, we all have access nowadays, thanks to streaming and YouTube and so forth. I always say we've all nowadays got the same record collection. Didn't used to be the case.
Yeah.
People like me had loads and other people didn't. Nowadays, everybody's got everything. And so, you know, what people don't have nowadays is a sense of chronology, of a sense of when something appeared and what came after it. Because it's all just there. It's just a click away, you know. And, of course, if you're Paul McCartney and you produce a new record like you did recently, your main competition comes from your old record.
Yes, yeah.
And that's terrible irony, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's quite hard to compete. If you're Paul McCartney, it's quite hard to compete against your old records, you know, but that's the new reality.
And as well, it's become kind of a monetizing exercise for a lot of these guys now, isn't it? Didn't Bob Dylan sold his back catalogue recently, didn't they? And there's a whole industry is built up around owning people's back catalogues.
Selling rights, it's clearly a good time to sell your rights. And if you're, you know, if you're Bob Dylan and you're whatever age he is, late 70s, you're really thinking, well, it's better off to have this large sum of money, which I can somehow disperse in whichever way he wants to, rather than leaving the complications of managing a catalogue to my heirs. There's a lot of money chasing music rights at the moment, so it's a good time to sell if you've got any. Yeah. I don't, but a lot of people are doing very well out of it.
Yeah. So listen, before we leave 1971, do you want to pick out, say, three or four kind of seminal albums from that time that were important?
Well, I mean, it's kind of, I always say if you had a Mercury Music Prize for 1971, which is UK records, you know, your contenders would be Pink Floyd's Metal, Led Zeppelin IV, Who's Next, David Bowie, Hunky Dory, Rod Stewart, Every Picture Tells a Story, and so on. And those are just the best known ones.
You know,
that alone, when you get to the Nick Drake's Brighter Laters and John Martin's Bless the Weather and all these kind of things.
I was looking there, L.A. Woman, which is the Doors' last album with Jim Morrison.
Well, yeah, when you got to America, you got What's Going On, you got Joni Mitchell's Blue, you got Carole King's Tapestry, as I think I mentioned earlier. You know, Sly and the Family Stone, There's a Riot Going On. Lots of these people's best records were made in 1971.
Now, in a funny way, David, you have had more influence, I would think, on the culture than a lot of those musicians, because you've had a long career in publishing. And now kids will be wondering what I'm talking about here, but there used to be this thing called music magazines. And they were, like when I was growing up, they were the most important thing in your life. And you knew when they came out and you cycled into town to get your Inky music magazine or maybe your Glossy one or whatever. And you set up a lot of those magazines and indeed other magazines, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I joined a company called EMAP in the late 70s when they just launched Smash Hits, you know. So I joined Smash Hits when it had just gone from monthly to fortnightly. And then, you know, Smash Hits was a huge success, you know, massive throughout the 80s until it got to the point in the late 80s where I think it sold nearly a million copies a fortnight, which is pretty remarkable at any time. But out of that, you know, we launched loads of other, you know, we launched teenage girls titles like Just 17, and we launched, you know, other music titles like Q and Mojo. And we launched film titles like Empire, because those were the days when, you know, magazines were like the internet is now, frankly.
Yeah.
They were the place you went to yeah. find out all the stuff that wasn't easy to find out anywhere else.
And they were also the place where you read about stuff that you knew your parents wouldn't approve of and that would scandalise them. And like you mentioned Just 17 there. That was reasonably controversial magazine at the time, wasn't it?
It was absolutely extraordinarily, controversial in its time. You know, regularly members of parliament were standing up in parliament complaining about, are we trying to pervert and corrupt the youth of Britain, and of course now we got social media, and I think whatever hazard might have been involved in reading Just 17 is nothing compared to the hazard that might come to you via Facebook or Twitter or all the various other means, yeah. Because. Yeah, I still believe this, that reading is always a good thing. any generation, any society is improved by reading. And frankly, it doesn't really matter what you read about. But I think we've realized this recently when we've just come to the end of 4 years with an American president who didn't read and just watched the television. You get a very different read of the world if you do that, I think. Whereas, I think the thing about music magazines, they've gone now, really, largely. And I think the thing to miss about them, if you are the music business, is that they provided the really important function of making those acts seem really important.
Yes.
And seem really charismatic. And in a way that I don't know if you can reproduce it in the digital world where everything's kind of provisional.
A teenager now might disagree with us two old duffers on that, and they might say Taylor Swift is a much more interesting 3D charismatic artist than Led Zeppelin ever were or whatever.
And I will not be in a position in 40 years' time to tell whether that's true or not.
Listen, you also... a magazine that I really think defined the zeitgeist of an era was Heat magazine. People will remember magazine. You were involved in setting that up as well. You kind of did in a way invent a kind of minor celebrity culture and reality TV culture. In a way, the Daily Mail kind of so-called sidebar of shame. Heat invented all that in a way, didn't it?
I suppose it did. Yes. Yes. That was slightly after I had anything, after I ceased really having much to do with it. But it was launched into that moment of, instant celebrity and reality shows and so forth. At the point it was launched, that hadn't really happened. It happened soon afterwards. And the magazine really latched onto it. And rode that wave hugely successfully for quite a few years. Of course, all those waves, they come and they go. They have their moment. All these things have their moment.
Is he gone now? Does it exist anymore?
No, it still exists.
Does it? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But I think the thing you have to remember about magazines in particularly the 80s and 90s, is if you launched a new magazine and you put it in a shop and you did a little bit of advertising or something behind it, people would try it. They would just go and pick it up and try it. Mm. And if it was any good, they'd come back to it. Well, nowadays, if you put a magazine in the shop, they won't try it because, we're all just interacting with loads and loads of different stuff all the time. And teenagers particularly, because teenagers used to sit on buses going to school passing around copies of magazines. They don't anymore. Clearly they don't at the moment. But, they're on the phones. And so the world moved into the phone. And that's a place it's very difficult for a magazine to follow it.
Yeah, and in fairness, the best bits of magazines often were those bitty bits at the beginning and at the end and everything. And that is exactly what you're getting all the time now, isn't it?
You're sending it to your mates, aren't you? Back and forth. It's social media.
This is a real note. This is turning into a real dad conversation here. But is there a generation now coming? They will never buy a magazine, will they?
Well, never say never, as I think somebody famously said. the oddest things come back. The LP record everybody thought was gone away, but it came back in a different form. I don't see any immediate sign of it, but I'll tell you what, if you do pick up a magazine, whether it's an old one or a new one, you get an experience with still, which is different from other kind of media, which is you see all kinds of different things alongside each other. So you don't just read the bit you want to read. You read the bit that's in the corner. You read the advert. You read all that kind of stuff. And I think that is still a very pleasant thing.
And there's almost a political thing there in that we didn't have that filter bubble. So you weren't just exposed to the things you thought you wanted to be exposed to and the views you agreed with and everything else. It, in a way, it broadened the mind, didn't it?
I think it's early that if you look back at the glory days of things like the NME, and you know the NME used to be half of it you didn't understand, and that was kind of part of the appeal of it.
Yes, you didn't understand.
You know, if you're 16 years old, you like to feel it slightly over your head. That's a good feeling, and you know, I think there were, I think generally there was civilizing influence, and I think it's sad in a way that they've gone, but loads of things go, you know, time marches on.
Yeah. Are you nostalgic for those days? There was a huge amount of money floating around in the music industries and everything then. You were treated very well, weren't you? It was a good old life.
It could be. It could be, yes, because, you know, press and publicity was a hugely important thing to, you know, to building an artist. And, yeah, it could be a nice life. You know, I've stayed in some nice hotels. I've been to some nice places. But I've also been to some miserable places. I've been to the Retford Porterhouse on a wet Tuesday night, you know, and all that kind of thing. It's not all glamour. It never was all glamour. A lot of it could be quite tiresome, you know. But that's just the way it goes.
And then you've had a kind of, you're a Zelig-like figure in a way, because you turn up as well, bizarrely, in Live Aid, don't you?
Oh, well, I was one of the presenters of BBC's Whistle Test, and that and the BBC end of it, of Live Aid, was done by the Whistle Test team. So I did my stint in the Perspex box underneath the roof of Wembley Stadium. In the boiling heat of, what was it, 13th of, was it June or July, I forget, 1985, where they wired you in and said, you can't move now, and there was no lavatory or anything up there when you were stuck up there. And, you know, I was just there as a succession of cavalcade of pop stars, great and small, was rowed in to sit on the sofa and be interviewed by me in between the acts, while everybody in the background tried to work out what was going on next. So it was, fun.
You were there for a very kind of what became a quite an iconic moment, weren't you?
When Bob Geldof dropped the F-bomb, I was the person sitting opposite him on the sofa. And all I remember thinking was, well, you've got to keep going. And all I remember thinking was, I do hope my mother isn't watching this, you know, because it was quite a big thing in those days. Nowadays, they're 10 a penny, those kind of outbursts.
Yeah. You were trying to give out the address. Is that what it was?
Oh, yeah. It was just, it's a very boring answer, really. It's, you know, because the BBC had to give viewers information in a certain order, and it had to be the address first, and then it had to be post office details, I think, or something. And then credit card kind of quite late in the day, because don't forget, it's 1985 and these things were just, they worked very slowly in those days. And I said, the address. And so Geldof said, F the address. And so forth.
And listen, I have on my notes here that, funnily enough, you know who was sitting on the couch? You probably remember. Ian Asprey from The Cult was there for some bizarre reason.
Was he there during that?
And Billy Connolly and Pamela Stevenson.
Billy Connolly said to me that day, my most treasured memory from Live Aid is I was up there with Billy Connolly when the Pretenders were on stage. And the Pretenders at that stage, there two members had died. I don't even remember the guitarist.
Yeah,
and bass.
Yeah.
And Billy Connolly looked at them and he said to me, I wouldn't join that group. And I said, why not? He says, nobody leaves.
Okay, listen, David Hepburn, we leave it on that note. And if people want to read more about 1971, just one of many books you've written is 1971, Never a Dull Moment, Rocks, Golden Hours. Pleasure to talk to you, David Hepworth, and we'll take a break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.